our service, our pastor, Mr. Randy Stiver.
Going to be a long conclusion, folks. But it will be a conclusion. Well, actually, we have a hymn at the end and all that kind of thing. Greetings, everybody. Nice, cool day to be out and about. Cambridge canceled. We blew through Cambridge. It was just fine there. I don't know where I'm used to the Dakotas and Montana, but the coldest place that I ever did services was in Indiana. A whole lot of times. We'd get a storm blowing in off Michigan, Lake Michigan, and we had Michigan City services, and then straight east was Elkhart, 55 miles, right in line with most of the lake effect wind. So if it really was a big wind, we'd get lake effect snow all the way to Elkhart. But Michigan City met in a school that was a mile off the lake. So we were inside the inner circle of the phenomenal wind chills and all that kind of thing. One Sabbath, we hardly ever canceled. We would have Spokesman's Club on Sunday morning, and it was 20 below zero. I remember driving down. This was at our Plymouth congregation. That's where when they met for club. We had three churches in a circuit. And I drove down there. I drove right through Amish country, and I came up to the state highway. And I pulled up behind what I called the Amish Suburban. It was the long buggy. And being pulled by two teams of horses. And they weren't big horses. These were 14 and a half hands probably, and they were a little shaggy on the coat because it was wintertime, but whatever breed was, they were matched for a pair of two. Matched four. They were all the same. And they took off across the highway when it was all clear, and it was so cold and so still that they were breathing explosively, and every time they would exhale, you'd get a form of basketball size of ice crystals. And then every time that would exhale, all the four horses were throwing two of these up at a time. And they held together. And as they drifted back to the front end of the coach, there was a little cushion of air there, and they would bump up. And they would float on behind the thing. And I sat there watching them go across, and I went across, and then I had to drive by them. There are those times when you wish you were a photographer and that you would have had the right kind of, really needed video for this one. But it was spectacular. I watched them in the mirror, and the original balls of ice crystals were still hovering across the road where they took off. And then following them on down the side road, which is what we were on, to wherever they lived. It's one of those, it was a great time. The other time that I would go to, that it got cold though, I went down to Plymouth, and I had to go to Michigan City because the pastor came to Elkhart where we lived. And I got up to Michigan City. We had services, and it was really cold. It was below zero out there, and the wind was blowing, and it was snowing, and finally it was time to go home. So we all stood around and talked. We weren't even in a hurry to go home. And I went out and found out that my carburetor on the Dodge Caravan, I had the third Dodge Caravan that arrived in Elkhart, Indiana. This is a winter of 1984. The third one. The dealer kept it for 3 days. It was on the church's fleet program. They kept it for 3 days before they even told me they had it so they could have it in the showroom. Did the same thing when the speedometer cable broke. A couple weeks later, they kept it for 4 days. Oh, we're waiting for the speedometer cable while it's sitting in the showroom again. The carburetor would freeze up on that thing. For the first 2 years, that's what they did. And it was 34 below zero when we got out there. And with the wind chill, it was 84, 85 below. And it wouldn't start. And I thought, I hope one of the mechanics hasn't left yet. Fortunately, two of them hadn't left. So they came down and sprayed de-icer all over the carburetor, and I got it going and limped it home. I couldn't get over about 45 miles an hour. But I was going with the wind, so I wasn't driving into the wind, or it would have frozen up along the way. It never dawned on us we should close services down. It's too much fun, In Montana, we ran between Missoula and Great Falls. And Missoula hardly ever got below zero. It does now once in a while, but in those days it didn't. Great Falls, however, in the center of the state, 30 below. But it was sissy, 30 below. It was like 15% humidity. in Indiana and later in Wisconsin, and we'd have 30 below when it was 60% humidity. Yeah, which is why the carburetors froze up. So anyway, we're hardy souls here on the Sabbath to enjoy this, and it's a gorgeous day out there. It was about 3 above when we left and dropped down at just on the other side of the Little Miami. That's that big gorge you go over on the bridge. It dropped to 2 below and then bumped up and down above 0 and below 0 all the way on across. And it was clear. The roads were dry. It was just a beautiful trip. Okay. Well, so much about that. I guess I should comment about our other cold weather experience that Brent was with me on. We were working at winter camp, and we teamed up to do winter survival, which was a ton of fun. We taught the kids how to throw the bola. Now, that's that South American thing. You got for ones used on birds, they put in 5 or 6 balls on cords. We used rubber balls so they were safe, you know, you can't have rocks flying through the air when you've got campers. But rubber balls you get at the dollar store. We taught them how the bola worked as a survival. This was a survival experience. Bear in mind, the survival class is always a success if they get to throw something. This time they threw two things. We did throwing sticks, which I learned in a survival class I took under a Norwegian commando, ex-Norwegian commando from World War II. Odd Bjerke was his name. When you are in a survival situation, don't throw rocks at birds because your rock will go through the air and it will create a hole in the air as big as the rock is. And the bird is not likely to coincide with any time of that hole in the air. But if you take a good stout stick and you throw the stick, it goes twirling through the air and it's a much bigger chance of bringing down a grouse or a duck or whatever, you know, you need to eat when you're in a starving situation. So Brent ran the stick throwing concession. I did the bola concession, and we got the technique on the bolas down pretty good. They got really good with the sticks. They were throwing them at frisbees, flying back and forth across their throwing area. It was like skeet shooting with sticks, and they hit a lot of frisbees. And when it was really cold, on the especially cold days, they broke about half of our frisbees. So we had them taped together with Gorilla Tape. So they'd still fly, and all went very well. It was probably the best organized camp, and that's largely thanks to Dan and Roxanne Dowd. He's the camp director, and Mrs. Dowd works right along with him on it. It was the best organized, easiest for the staff to work in when it's put together well, and for the campers. And the group of campers we had, it was probably as fine a group as I've seen at any camp. But there's a reason why, I think. Winter camp is not for the warm-blooded and the soft livers. It is for those who are ready for the cold. We got some below zero weather the last several days. The camp out was at zero, I think it got down to. Did it get below zero? 10 below with wind chill. 10 below with wind chill, yeah. And fortunately, they were in their tents. And then the last night, it got dropped down to about, I don't know, 3 or 4 below when we were getting packed up the next morning. And it didn't come up till we were gone. I don't think it got above zero until we were all ready to get on the highway about mid-morning. So it was good winter camp. But winter camp this year landed right on top of winter family weekend. It's for people who like to play indoors and throw balls back and forth, you know, and dance and stuff. Well, we did dancing too, but those who went to winter camp had to choose to go there. You couldn't do both. They had to choose, and therefore they were motivated. They wanted to be there, and when you want to be someplace, you want it to be good and to be a good productive time. And they were all in that kind of a focus. We had some wonderful dorm meetings with Brent was the dorm dad of one of the boys' dorms. I was on the other one. And we had exceptionally good staff. It was the best camp. You know, I've worked in United Youth camps for a long time, directed a couple of camps, you know, in transition years, but worked at them every year for forever, it seems like. And this was the best I've seen. So that's a little bit of news. And we did have a couple of other prayer requests that I think Mr. Wilson forgot to get into the, or else I forgot to send them to him. That's probably what happened. But from the North Canton area, let me give you a couple of them. Joe Gabriel, one of our oldest deacons there, is got cancer. He's just finished his first round of chemo. They're using a pill. They say works better than the other chemos that they use for that cancer. And I'm not exactly sure what kind of cancer it is. Yeah, he went through the regimen with that for, I think, about 2 weeks, no side effects. He's had a week off. He'll be starting another chemo treatment, again, a different pill this coming week. So please keep Joe in your prayers for God's healing. He's in great spirits, big booming voice when we talk on the phone. I haven't had a chance to drop by to see them recently, but hope to this coming week. Also, the Murdochs. If you'll remember, Dolores had the congestive heart attack during the feast. And then she had to have ultimately a tracheotomy and so on and so forth. Well, it was getting better, and then it started getting worse, and it was harder and harder for her to breathe there at home. So they went back in, and the doctor said, you're going to have another tracheotomy so you can breathe. You've got scar tissue on your inside your throat. And that occurred based on the surgeon that did the tracheotomy this past week, which went very well. And they're actually supposed to be home, and Joe will be looking at, Ray will be looking after her tracheotomy appliance there. But the surgeon was very pleased with how it went, but she put the little camera down, you know, little thin camera that goes down and looks at it. She said there's a great deal of scar tissue. That was what was blocking your airway. And that was from down in Cincinnati. They tried to take the breathing tube out after they got her stabilized and her throat constricted, and she was about to die from not being able to get air. So they had to shove it back down in, and that's when the damage occurred and the scar tissue is built up. So the surgeon at University Hospital in Cleveland, very impressed with her. She happened to come in while I was visiting them the other day, and she explained that there'll be another surgery. They'll go in and clear that out, and there's some other vocal cords, so she should be able to regain most of the volume and such of her vocal cords that she hadn't been able to do up to now. So that's the Murdochs. Let me see. George Rusnick was in the hospital, or one of our other deacons. He got a leg infection, which turned into cellulitis, you know, a huge pocket of infection. He got that cleared out. Sometimes you get it from spider bite. Other times you get it from, you got an abrasion or a cut or something, and he was at the gym and got into a lukewarm hot tub. That's not a good thing to get into generally at all at gyms. And anyway, that's where he thinks that happened. He is home and doing better, and again, in good spirits as well. And there's one other one on my mental list, because I don't have, who else did I see? Well, that's in Wisconsin. We lost a deacon in Wisconsin. This is Mr. Dowd's area. Roger Burns, he wasn't down at the camp, but one of their longtime deacons from, yeah, again, some kind of a heart, not a heart attack exactly, but his heart stopped and he fell and injured, and was severely injured and didn't recover. There's somebody else that I'm forgetting, though, from North Canton, and probably come to me in the middle of the sermon and will interrupt the sermon to have another announcement at that time. The title, let's just start with a title to begin with and get into this. It's The Truth from Ruth. The Truth from Ruth. Actually, it's about the book of Ruth. We drew had lessons in winter camp. The theme this year was character. Leaders, people of character. That was the theme. So we're focusing on character. And then for the Christian living class, because we have a Christian living class for every dorm every day, that was the main class. Then they have other Bible classes periodically through the week as well. But this particular one day was Ruth, and the quality of character that Ruth exhibited was integrity, always doing the right thing, essentially is how integrity is defined. So it set me to thinking about the book of Ruth. I teach the writings class still yet for ABC. I go down and do this on a module basis. And a module is where instructor comes in and stays at the office in the whole area there. And they teach the first 2 hours of the class day, 8:30 to 10:30, 5 days a week. So we cram a whole other class in doing the module program. And I teach the writings. The writings class is a section of the Old Testament. There were three sections to the Old Testament. One is the law. That would be the Pentateuch or the five books of Moses. The next one are the prophets, and that's all the prophets except for one. And then the third section is referred to by Christ in Luke chapter 22 as the Psalms, because that's the dominant book in the middle of it. It's actually the writings. In Hebrew, they call it the Ketuvim, which means the writings. All the other writings. And that includes Ruth, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Lamentations, and Daniel. In that order. And so Ruth comes into that. So I've had the privilege of teaching Ruth for the past several years. And it's always a fascinating book. Turn to it and do an overview, give you a little bit of background on the book so that you'll appreciate it. And there's a big lesson. We're going to analyze how Ruth ultimately is a microcosm of God's church in certain ways. It's a great way to analyze the experiences that we've gone through historically and sometimes go through even now and draw that lesson from something else, in this case, the events of the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is set during the time of the judges. So this would be a time frame generally classified as between 1380 and 1050 B.C. Remember, you're counting down in B.C. from 1380 to 1050 B.C. 1050 is when Saul became king. And that came to the end of the judges. The last judge, therefore, was Samuel. And so Ruth was sometime earlier than Samuel. It's very hard to tell exactly when, but we just lump it into the time of the judges. It's a story of moral uprightness or integrity in contrast to the era's repeated immorality. And the time of judges was a time of immorality. And you know the famous scripture, the very last verse of the book of Judges. If you're in the book of Ruth, you can look at it. It's verse 25 of chapter 21. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And that was the way the time of the judges was like. Except that there was some commonality that we'll see in the book of Ruth. There were horrendous times of immorality, and it didn't always pervade all the tribes. Bear in mind, you had the war that almost annihilated the tribe of Benjamin in the middle or early part of the judges. You had various other events. The Manassites who thrashed the Ephraimites. It was the American Revolution fought the first time under Jephthah, where the Ephraimites had this lousy accent. They couldn't say Shibboleth. You know, it came out Sibboleth. They couldn't say the SH sound, and if they couldn't say it, they died when they crossed the river, you know. It was a lovely bunch, you know. They were supposed to be one nation, and they always on each other's case. The book of Ruth, though, has some of the everyday life of what was going on then. And it actually is a remarkable historical study for us in understanding the ancient Israelite culture and therefore the Bible's culture of the Old Testament, that part of it. It's a case study of village and rural culture. For example, you have an example of how famine could affect local immigration, which is why Elimelech and Naomi moved from Israel, from actually Bethlehem, or Ephrath. Ephrath was the other name for Bethlehem. Sometimes they run them together, Bethlehem, Ephrathite from Bethlehem. But they moved from there, where they were of the tribe of Judah. That was where their land inheritance was. The inheritances were handed out by Joshua under God's direction when they first came into the promised land. But because of this particular famine, they moved to Moab. Moab would be today part of the nation of Jordan. We believe the Moabites and the Ammonites. Remember, the capital of Jordan, for example, is Ammon. That's Ammon of old. And they were relatives of the Israelites. They were descendants of Lot. And Lot was a nephew of Abraham. So they were relatives. And throughout the history, Moab and Ammon, usually as a unit and sometimes separately. Sometimes they were allies of the Israelites, and sometimes they were fighting bitter wars. Well, at this time, they were fairly copacetic, so it was a safe place for them to go, and there was food there. They were having better crops. The book of Ruth also gives us a detailed account of the barley harvest, one of the main food grains. They had barley and they had wheat. They didn't have maize, as we call it, which is corn, at least that we are aware of, but we do know they had the small grains. Barley and any type of ancient wheat, it would probably be more akin to spelt. And I don't know how you spell that, but yes, I do. But you get a detailed account of how a barley harvest worked. You have the details of the use of the threshing floor. We don't know anything about threshing floors today. We have them. You know where the modern threshing floors are contained? In the belly of the $150,000 to $200,000 combines that go up and down our grain fields. That's where the threshing floors are. They did it differently in those days, so a lot more handwork. And right now it's all contained in that center section of all these massive combines. We don't get to see it happen. In those days, you saw the threshing floor in action every harvest. It was an example of how a leveret marriage worked. A leveret marriage doesn't mean like you're leveraging something by investing here or investing there or trying to price something off of something else. It comes from the Hebrew word levir, L-E-V-I-R, which means husband's brother. So Ruth ended up with a leveret marriage. There was no brother, so then you go to the next of kin. Ultimately, that was Boaz, except there was one guy that was closer even than Boaz. And then, likewise, connected with the leveret marriage is the kinsman redeemer's role in redeeming the property of someone who dies. Remember, land was divided all out. It was essentially in Israel, it was against the law to not own land. You had to own it. And your family was given an allotment, and then that was passed down through the generations, from generation to generation. And it was all contained within the tribe that you were a part of. So this is how a close kinsman could redeem the land if somebody fell on hard times because of a famine or because of whatever happened to be. They could redeem the land. And also an example of a legal transaction done by the village elders in the city gate. The city gate was like the courthouse of our modern times today, except the elders would meet at the gate and they would sit there. When we were on the tour in Israel this past spring, we got to see where there would be somebody who presided over this, essentially a court of the elders. And there was usually at the gate, there would be, it seemed to be cross-cultural. The other cultures all had a similar kind of process. There was a place where somebody would be sitting in review, you know, sort of chairing things. And the elders would all gather around, usually sitting on the ground, maybe on stone benches, as the case might be. Boaz was one of those elders. And he dealt with old so-and-so. That who was the nearer of kin through one of those. Now, who wrote the book of Ruth? This is interesting. Traditionally, Samuel is credited with having written it. Now, Samuel was one of the last judge. But you think, well, yeah, but it's written from Naomi's perspective. And that's probably the case, that it was a oral tradition of Naomi that she had handed down, and then it was carried on down to however long it was till Samuel came around, then Samuel wrote it down. There were additions, or additions, later in the time of David and Solomon. Let me show you that. In the last several verses of chapter 4, now bear in mind, God inspired the edits and the additions as time went by. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife in verse 13. And I want to begin in verse 18. This is verse 17 and 18 we want. Also, the neighbor women gave him a name, that is, they're saying, there was a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed, which means one who serves. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Well, obviously, it couldn't have been written down, you know, immediately. And it also dates Ruth as being near the end of the period of Judges, sometime perhaps earlier, just earlier than Samuel. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez, and we have Perez going all the way down. He was one of the sons of Judah, all the way down to the time of David. So that genealogy and verse 17 would have had to have been added later because you had to have a great-grandkid, or a great-grandkid had to be born. He had to become a grandchild of significance, which David did, for it then to be added. So that would have been added in David or Solomon's time. And then in chapter 4, also in verse 7, notice this comment. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. So, you know, when you're going to go make a deal, don't wear, you know, your really super expensive shoes. Wear just good shoes. Because when you make the transaction, you sell a property, you have to take off your shoe and give it to the guy who's giving you the money. And the symbolism is that he now has the right to walk on that property. And so you're giving him the sandal. Now, the sandal significance has sort of continued in the Middle East. Remember, the Arab nations, if they want to insult you, they throw their shoe at you. And that happened to President Bush once during a press conference in Iraq. He ducked, missed, and the guy then was overpowered, as you would expect, but it wasn't an explosive shoe or anything, which was fortunate. So you find some very interesting aspects to this. There are key themes, and we want to understand the themes that will give us some analysis at the end when we begin to compare the book of Ruth to the church. God will call all peoples to salvation. Everybody. Nobody's left out. All the pygmy tribes of the Ituri forest in the Congo will be called. The Hutsis and the Tutus. Hutus and the Tutsis. I get it wrong here. The Hutus and the Tutsis of Rwanda. That's the part of Africa where the gibbons apes roam. And the apes seem to get along better than the Hutus and the Tutsis. In the mid-1990s, there were about 300,000 Tutsis slaughtered by their Hutu neighbors with machetes. They didn't need high-speed weapons to kill that many people. It's tragic, horrendous war in Rwanda. There was another tribe there, though, as well. Nobody knows about them. They were the Pygmies of Rwanda. They're the Twa. I know about this because we had a student at ABC last year, Stephen Kusi, who was from Ghana, but before he was called into the church, he served in the military and military intelligence, which you thought, wow, espionage? No. That means I dress like the locals and drift into the crowd and slip out into where the enemy is encamped, and I size up his position and, you know, his strength, and then I slip back through the crowd and go back to my superiors. That's what it was. So he dealt with the Twa, because he was a UN observer in Rwanda during that time, which was, he saw the horrendous bloodlust that was going on and what the Hutus were doing to the Tutsis. The Tutsis are a smaller, slender tribe, and the Hutus were really big and strong. And the Twa, nobody paid any attention to them. They drifted in and out of the forest. They traded a little bit. He talked to the Twa because they told him, that's where he got his intelligence often, was asking them. The Twa will be called to God's truth. So will the Hutus. So will the Tutsis. They'll have some things to repent of. Everybody does. That's marvelous. The Moabites and the Ammonites will be called to repentance as well. All peoples will be called. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. That's 1 Peter 3 and verse 9. 1 Peter 3 and verse 9. Now, that's the overriding theme of the book of Ruth. Ruth is not an Israelite. She's not of the 12 tribes. She is not technically a daughter of Abraham, although she comes from a family line that was related to Abraham. She's a Shemite, descended from Shem, who was one of the ancestors of Abraham and one of the sons of Noah. Here are the sub-themes. Number one, loyal love. Ruth's love for Naomi is proverbial, for her mother-in-law. Sometimes it's called covenantal love. In other words, it is a love that keeps promises. And Ruth had the integrity to keep her promises and maintain her family connection with Naomi. And that's the kind of love that God has for all of us. Redemption is another sub-theme. God redeemed Ruth and Naomi from poverty by motivating Boaz, who was a close relative, to do his duty and take them under his wing. He provided for them. Because when he married Ruth, he got Naomi in the package. He had to provide for her in her old age. So he expanded his family, and he was willing and honored to do that. And when you look at Boaz's responses, it has the theme of the kinsman redeemer who was a close relative with the means and resources to save a relative from slavery or poverty, which was what Boaz did, and from losing their ancestral land, the kinsman redeemer. So he was willing to do that. Christ is our redeemer and is called such in the book of Galatians. So that was a type of what Christ is for all of us. And then the lever at marriage was another responsibility of a kinsman redeemer. In this case, he would take the impoverished widow to be his wife, and the first son born would be the heir of her first husband. And the land that she essentially controlled on behalf of her little son would not go to her second husband. It would go to that son, who was counted as the legal heir of her first husband. Her first husband was Mahlon, M-A-H-L-O-N. We'll get to that as we do a skim through on the story here in a moment. So that's the lever at marriage. And that was a part of how it was done. Now let's look at chapter by chapter, do a quick review here as we're looking at the book of Ruth. Then we'll get into an analysis of how it applies to us in the church today. We know there's a famine, and that's talked about right at the beginning. Came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. And his name was Elimelech. In the movie they made of Ruth, they turned it into a movie back in the, I think it was the late 50s, it cast Elimelech and his sons as gold workers, that they worked in gold. And they weren't specifically farmers, although everybody owned land. They worked primarily in precious metals. Maybe, we don't know, doesn't really say one way or the other, but you know, that could have been a tradition that they found in their research for the movie. So Elimelech and Naomi took their sons. They moved to Moab because there wasn't enough food in Judea, in the land of Judah, and the rest of the tribes to support them. So they scattered out to where food was, which was wise. That left what food they could produce in Bethlehem, Judah, or any area, for the ones who stayed. So it was kind of a cooperative effort to just keep surviving. Well, Elimelech died after they got to Moab. They lived there a little while, and then he died. And then her two sons married. They married women from Moab. And the name of one was Orpah, which my dorm full of boys rued the fact that they could not remember that name. We had an amazing race which had a lot of Bible trivia in it. And it was running from one place to another. There was this first full day of camp, and there was a full afternoon of this. And they had to answer these Bible questions. They were Bible trivia that mostly they should know. Well, they couldn't remember the name of Ruth's sister-in-law. And they tried, and they came very, very close. Ophrah. But not Orpah. So on the day we covered the book of Ruth, they remembered it very, very well. So anyway, one Chilion married Orpah, and Mahlon married Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years, and then both Mahlon and Chilion died. So Naomi's sons died. Her husband died. Her sons got married. Things were looking better. Then they got sick and died. We don't know what, you know, how they died, but they died. And now there she was left with her two daughters-in-law. And she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return to the country of from the country of Moab, because she had heard that the famine had been relieved. That's the next section of this, starting in verse 6. And so she told them, "My daughters, go back to your families, back to your gods. You're from Moab. I've got to go back to Israel." And she kissed them and lifted up their voices. They all lifted their voices and wept. And they said, "No, we want to go with you and to your people." And she said, "Turn back, my daughters," in verse 11. Notice how she called them her daughters, not daughters-in-law. Naomi was a remarkable woman, you know, very kind and loving, and had to be a sterling example of God's way of life. And then she said this odd thing, "Turn back," in verse 12, "my daughters, for I am too old to have a husband. And if I should say I have hope, and if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them until they're grown?" See, she's talking about the levirate marriage. That was thoroughly understood. That was a part of the culture for her to bring it out in this kind of a setting. So there were certain aspects of God's way, of God's truth, that were the underlying legal processes of the period of the judges. Then there were other times when they went to worship the pagan gods. That was all done through sexual debauchery. Sexual immorality was the way the pagan gods and goddesses were all worshipped. That's why it was such a big pull. You know, the way you worship the pagan gods and goddesses was through ceremonial, or literal, but ceremonial or ritualistic fornication. That's how they were worshipped, like the gods of rock stars are worshipped today, and et cetera, you know, in a relative sense. So we have, there was a lot of sexual immorality, but underlying that, there were underpinnings of the functioning of the society which were drawn from God that he had laid down through Moses. So they lifted their voices and wept. In verse 14, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her own people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." And Ruth said, entreat, and this is the very famous and magnificent piece, and the direct quote about from Ruth that is, you know, timeless. "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God, and where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Eternal, do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you from me." Ruth had chosen the true religion. She was a worshiper of the true God, not the pagan gods of Moab anymore. She had changed. This now, the God of Israel, was her God. And therefore, she wanted to be a part of Israel, not a part of Moab. So Naomi couldn't talk her out of it, said, "All right, well, let's go." So off they went, and they got there, and everybody said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said, "No, it's not Naomi. Call me Mara," which means bitterness. And then she told him of what had happened. Her husband died, her sons died, and they arrived back at the last verse at the time of the beginning of the barley harvest. That would mean it would be shortly after Passover. Remember, in the days of unleavened bread, on the morrow after the Sabbath, during the days of unleavened bread, there is a special offering that would be done at the temple. It was the wave sheaf offering. They would take a sheaf of grain. As it's time to be harvested, it's still fairly green. It has to dry. They take the sheaf of grain, and then they would wave it. The priest would, in a ceremony, he would wave it as a part of an offering. And after that, the barley harvest could commence. Then the spring, or the early harvest, began. And then that was concluded. It took a long time, all the way up to Pentecost. Pentecost was called the Feast of First Fruits because that was the feast of when the first fruits, the early harvest, was completed. Then the big harvest was commemorated with the Feast of Tabernacles. So this would have been shortly after Pentecost or Passover that they had arrived. Ruth meets Boaz. She understands the culture. Gleaning was probably a part of the culture everywhere. In fact, so that we understand this better, let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning of 25 and the last part of Deuteronomy 24, and just read several verses here to understand. First, gleaning in chapter 24 of Deuteronomy, starting in verse 19. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field. Now, sheaf is a fistful of stalks of wheat, a big double fistful. And they would cut that with a scythe. They would, the harvesters would roll their arm around it, standing grain, until they had a sheaf full tucked in under their hand and behind their wrist. And then they would hit the bottom of that with their scythe, their hand scythe. They could be stone or metal. Stone would have flint knives that were embedded in wood. And the metal ones would just be sharpened metal like the scythes that we used to have until we got weed whackers. So, weed whackers don't make good sheaves. They splatter everything everywhere. But the scythe worked. And they would cut it, and then they would, since they have their hand wrapped around it, then they'd scoop, drop the scythe, grab three or four strands of wheat and form that, you know, weave it, or not weave it, but you know, roll it into a cord. And that would be how they would tie the sheaf together, is with those particular strands of the wheat plant itself. Then it would sit there on its end with the bottom, just like it had been before it was cut. It would sit there with the grain at the top. And then later they come and collect those sheaves after they dried in the field for a while into usually carts, ox carts. And those would be hauled up to the threshing floor where they cut off the head of the grain, because you could take a sheaf and you could do that with another blade. And then you would allow have the oxen walk around on the heads of grain, which broke the grain and the chaff apart. Didn't hurt the grain. It just started to separate the grain and the chaff. Then on the threshing floor, they would have large baskets, you know, 4 or 5 feet in diameter, maybe this high, from the ones that I've seen pictures of at least. And they would have formed a lattice. And they couldn't go to Lowe's and just buy some screen. That would be easy. They had to make it painstakingly by weaving, which is easy to do. Basket weaving and just leave spaces between so that you'd have a basket. So the wheat couldn't go through it. And you would stand on a threshing floor. Threshing floor was an elevated, flat, usually a rock platform, because some grain would fall. You'd have to sweep it up, and that way you didn't get dirt in it. And you would toss it into the air, and the wind was always blowing on these spots. That's why they were much sought after, the threshing floors. And the wind would blow the chaff downwind off the side of the hill, and pretty soon all you're doing is tossing pure grain up. And when you realize that, you stop tossing, because that's a lot of work, and you start dumping into your spot in the threshing floor area to store, and then later it'd be bagged and be hauled home and stored. So that's how the threshing all worked. But gleaning was a part of that. So when you forget a sheaf in the field, leave it there. It shall be for the stranger and the fatherless and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And when you beat your olive trees, don't go over the boughs again. You give them a good beating. By a beating, that doesn't mean you're trying to damage the tree. You're tapping the branches, and the ripe olives come showering down, landing on blankets or tarps that you've laid down to collect them. We used to do that with buffalo berries. I remember as a little child in Nebraska, my father used canvas dams. These were portable dams for irrigating in the ditches. And so he just laid a whole string of these all in a circle around this buffalo berry tree. It was a big tree, you know. The berries would grow out on the twigs and up the side, and they were these trees were the yellow variety. Then there was the super bright red-orange ones. We had those in South Dakota. They were terribly sour. We loved them, but the way my brother and I would eat them is we especially liked it when somebody, some greenhorn was with us, didn't know what they were. And we'd get, these are really good. So everybody get a handful. Y'all ready? We all eat our handfuls at the same time. And, of course, the uninitiated would just go into spasms from the bitterness. We knew that you had to adjust your sweet, your sweet calibrator in your mind. The first mouth was phenomenally sour. The second mouth was slightly sour. And the third mouth was, it's not bad. And the fourth mouthful, they were as sweet as they could be. And then so you had to get to the fourth mouthful, then you were good. We knew that. They didn't know that. That was part of the fun of being a farm kid and taking city slickers out to experience the joys of working with farm kids for a day. Well, the olive trees would have been beaten the same way. My father would throw a lasso around one of the branches, high branches that, on the main trunk, and he would just stand back and shake that tree, and all those berries would fall down. And my grandmother then would process them and turn them into some of the finest jelly you ever tasted. So if you beat the boughs or the branches of the tree, don't beat it again. You leave whatever stays for the fatherless and the stranger and the widow. And when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, don't glean it afterwards. Go through, pick it, but don't worry about it. So that you weren't picking really, really neatly and you left some. This is the one time in God's way of life where sloppy work is rewarded. And that is, you don't harvest everything. Leave it for those who need it. I read this as a teenager and wondered, how can we do this? We grow hay and corn, but there's nobody around us anywhere that could come and what would they want with the hay anyway? And the only thing I could think of, about the only thing you could do for gleaning is, because we were always a little bit sloppy, is you collect that, make an estimate, and send it in as, third tithe of or for the third tithe-type fund. So he said, you will remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. So gleaning. Ruth went to glean. We're going to read about that in a moment. And then down in chapter 25. So we'll look at this section. This is the levirate marriage. Starts in verse 5. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, then the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother, the levir, the husband's brother, shall go into her and take her as a wife. So he will marry his sister-in-law, who was his late brother's wife. And it shall be in verse 6 that the firstborn son that she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother. He will be the descendant, legally, of the dead brother, and inherit his land holdings. And his name shall not be blotted out of Israel. But if a man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel, and he will not perform the duty of my husband's brother, of the levir. And the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him, but if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his wife's brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, and spit in his face. And answer and say, so shall it be done to a man who does not build up his brother's house, and his name shall be called in Israel the house of him whose sandal was removed. It's kind of like that baseball player called Shoeless Joe. So there's the lesson. That was the way it was set up under the old covenant for ancient Israel. The principles, there are principles of taking care of family and of providing for the poor that we have in the new covenant as well. Now we come back to chapter 2. Ruth goes out to glean in the field. And Naomi says, go and do it. And she happened in verse 3, in the middle of it, she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. So some land would be so large that there would be many people's fields, sort of up against each other. She just by a happenstance, although guided by God, can be sure. And Boaz came from Bethlehem, checking on his harvest. He was fairly well-to-do. How old was he? We don't know. How old was Ruth? We don't know. Was she in her 30s? He might have been in his 40s or maybe 50s. He was a little bit older than she was. So the servant in charge told her, well, that's Naomi's daughter-in-law. That's Ruth. And asked if she could glean, and she's been working at it all morning. And Boaz says to her, he went up to her in verse 8, and she says, do not go and glean in another field. He tells this to Ruth. But stay here. Stay close by my women. My young men will leave you alone, and you can eat where they eat and drink where they drink. And she fell on her face in verse 10 and bowed down. She says, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, for I am a foreigner? She understood she was not of Israel. And Boaz said to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your family, your father and mother in the land of your birth, and have come to the people you did not know before. The Eternal repay you, or reward you for your work, and full reward will be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. And then she said, and notice what she says in verse 13 compared to verse 10. Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant. No longer is she a foreigner. Now she sees herself as a maidservant, a part of Israel in that sense. Then Boaz goes to his harvesters and he said, hey, guys, come over here. I'm going to talk to you in a minute. That's Ruth. You know the story about Naomi, her mother-in-law. He said, I want you to get really sloppy in your harvesting. Drop grain on purpose. Pretend you didn't notice. Just leave it laying around. And I want her to glean among the sheaves. So right up behind you. And make sure she does well. So she did. And what Ruth took home that day was an ephah of barley. And you're like, oh, wow, a whole ephah. Is that like a mug full? An ephah was an ancient measurement. It was equal to about 65% of one of our modern bushels. And a bushel of barley is rated at about 48 pounds. So it was like 31 pounds of grain. That's a fair haul of grain. That's nothing. She carries that home on her head. And they carried everything on their heads in those days, which is probably a better thing than what we do. So Naomi was impressed and thrilled. Chapter 3, Naomi hatches the plot. She knows the levirate responsibility. She knows the gleaning laws. That's all a part of the culture. That part of God's truth was being maintained in Bethlehem. And maybe even more of God's truth being maintained there than had been in other parts of Israel. So she has to harvest, stays with Boaz's people the entire harvest, all the way up close to Pentecost. And then her mother-in-law hatched the plot. So at the end of the harvest, they're finishing up with the winnowing of the barley. And so she said, I want you to get up dressed in your finest clothes, get all prettied up like you should be, and go down there. And there'll be kind of a feast, and not a religious feast, but just the big meal, kind of celebrating, we got the job done kind of a thing. And you notice where he goes to sleep. And where he went to sleep is on top of his barley in there at the threshing floor. It would be stacked someplace. If there was no rain coming, then it could be outdoors. Otherwise, they would have it under some kind of a tent awning. So then you lie down at his feet. And what is this lying down at somebody's feet? It is a sign of submission. Often people who had servants, when they traveled in cold weather, the servants had to sleep at the master's feet to keep their feet warm. You know, well, kind of a rum deal. What about the servants' feet? Well, I don't know. If they were wealthy enough to have shoes, well, they're servants. Yeah. Anyway, it was a sign of submission. And it carried another meaning, too. So she did that, and she came softly at the end of verse 7 and uncovered his feet, and she lay down. In the middle of the night, he woke up and all of a sudden realized somebody was at his feet. And he said, who are you? And she said, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. In other words, she was saying, I want you to marry me and perform the levirate responsibility for my late husband, Malon. And blessed are you, who you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, because you did not go after the young man, but you came to me, and here I'm an older guy. Maybe he was bald by this time, who knows. But he was an honest and a true leader in Israel. And so he says, however, there is one more relative closer in relation to Melon than me. And I will approach him tomorrow. And if he says he will do it, then fine, if he'll marry you. If not, then we'll let God decide this. So she lay at his feet in the morning, and he got up before it was, you know, very light, so you could see who was who. And he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. That's like 150 pounds. How did she carry 150 pounds of barley? Ruth was no, you know, weakling by any means. Most of that's on her head. And then the only way I can think, you can only carry so much on your head. She had to have a bag in each hand to balance herself out. So she packed that all the way back. It is as, you know, this was a sign of his genuineness that he was going to do what he said. Now, so the day dawned, he went to the gate, sat down at the gate, and he waited until the close relative came by and said, hey, so-and-so, come over here. And you think, what do you mean, so-and-so? In Hebrew, that's exactly what he said. Pilani Elani. Hey, Pilani Elani, come over here. That's the way they say so-and-so, according to the commentary I was looking at. So it gets rendered friend here, but it is literally so-and-so in Hebrew. So he came and he sat down, and then Boaz made sure there were 10 elders of the city sitting there to judge, make it official. So here we have how legal decisions were made in the community at the time. And then he told the story of Naomi's come back from the country of Moab. She sold a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. And if you redeem it, redeem it. If you will not, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I'm next after you. And so so-and-so said, well, okay, I'll redeem it. Yeah, I want more land. And Boaz says, okay, well, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also have to buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, and perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. In other words, he couldn't add this land to his estate. This would always be the estate of Melon and Elimelech through him. And then when the close relative said, well, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. In other words, I'm not willing to do it. And as this was the custom in former times, he took off his sandal, because Ruth wasn't there to take it off and spit in his face. So he took off the sandal and made it official. And he said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off the sandal, and the elders were all witnesses to it. And then Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Melon, was able then to marry Boaz, as the rest of the story goes. They are all witnesses, and they said, may you be like the house of Perez, who was one of the great forefathers of the tribe of Judah. And then the rest of it was added later. So there gives us the overview of it. Now let's just look for the last few minutes here, some lessons. First of all, there is a principle. When we look into the Old Testament, we compare the old to the new. We compare ancient Israel to the church of God. And there is a correlation. Let's notice how that can be conducted, because it's inspired to be conducted in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4. The story of Ruth is just jam-packed with wisdom of integrity and faithfulness and, genuine love for family. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4, the Apostle Paul makes a statement, which, of course, this is inspired. This is part, therefore, of God's word. This is, therefore, how we should reason. He talks, first of all, in verse 10, verse 1, moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. When they went through the Red Sea at the Exodus, God's presence in the cloud was right on top of them, essentially forming a water vapor barrier so that they were water to the left of them, water to the right of them, and water above them. And they were baptized, therefore. It was a symbolic baptism of the whole nation. Into Moses, in the cloud, and in the sea, and they all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock which followed them. That was referring to the Lord God of the Old Testament. The rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. So we see then that ancient Israel followed Christ. The church of God follows Christ. Christ was the leader of ancient Israel. They were disobedient quite often. He is also the leader of the Church of God. So when we can therefore draw connections back and forth. Notice Acts chapter 7. This is Stephen's apology, as they call it. It doesn't mean he says he's saying he's sorry. This is his defense of the faith. That led to his martyrdom, actually. But in verse 38 of Acts 7, this is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him in Mount Sinai, and with our fathers, the one who received him, living oracles to give to us. And do I have the right? Yes, I went right past it. This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness, referring to God and Moses there. The congregation in the wilderness. The New King James renders it church in the wilderness. Congregation, church. See the word? So we have ancient Israel was the church in the wilderness, and it corresponds to the church of God today, the spiritual church of God. The lesson, therefore, is there was physical Israel and there is spiritual Israel. So we can compare lessons back and forth through the sections of the Bible. Finally, notice Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16. Galatians 6 and verse 16. Paul makes another comment here that helps us understand this relationship again even better. Here it is. Galatians chapter 6, verse 16. And as many as walk according to this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. That's not talking about physical Israel specifically. It is talking directly about the true church, because that's who Paul was writing to. And Galatians was, to a large extent, they were Gentile Christians. There always were some Jewish Christians that were there, and probably some who were actually from some of the other tribes. Galatia was actually named after some of the tribes of Israel. It was a kingdom that they had established, which the Romans overran eventually. But this was mostly Gentiles he was speaking to, and calls them the Israel of God. So it's the church is the Israel of God, spiritual Israel, in other words. Hebrews chapter 11 is the faith chapter. It's a prime example, the whole thing, about the lessons of the Old Testament that we pull forward into the New Testament or into the New Covenant, from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. Ruth, therefore, was a microcosm of God's church historically as well as the church today. For example, let's just look at a few comparisons and set your mind to thinking, and you can finish this sermon in your own meditations today. Some are born into the church, like Naomi, Boaz, Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion. But others are called from outside the church, out of the world. And that would be like Ruth. So it's important that we can realize that both can and must be equally dedicated to following God. Whether we're born in the church, and we have, you know, we're in a time in our history where we have many of our members were born in the church. Many are third and even fourth generation true Christians in the God's church, when you take us across the board in United and in the greater Church of God as well. Back in the early days when Mr. Armstrong was starting out, there were very few. Some who came from the Church of God Seventh Day, but very few were in that category. But today it's more like it was in Ruth's day. There were the few that were being called out from out the outside and others who were growing up in the faith. There was an underlying culture in the time of the judges, which was God's truth. The Levir relationship, the levirate marriage, the gleaning, the land transactions, there was a core of body of God's law that was being followed. Then they disobeyed in other ways in various areas, but there was a core at the bottom that allowed the society to function. It was the repository of what part of God's truth was known and was actively being followed. Likewise, in the church, God's way is found, or God's truth is found, in his true church. It's not found in the churches of society. Well, they have bits and pieces, indeed. They do not understand God's plan. They have wrong doctrines. doctrines they got from Greek philosophers, not from the Bible. See, you can't compare us directly to the church, the Christian churches of the world today, because we are different, dramatically different. Israel was dramatically different from the nations around it in those days. Ruth recognized that. We have challenges, and think back about the church's experience, our own experience. Let's look in Acts chapter 20. The Apostle Paul here is warning the elders from Ephesus. He's on his way to Jerusalem, where he thinks he'd probably be martyred. He wasn't on that trip. Martyrdom came later. But in verse 17 to 20, he warned them of what would happen. He said to them in verse 18, "You know that from the first day that I came to Asia," of Acts 20, verse 18 now, "in what manner I always lived among you, serving the Lord with all humility," in verse 19, "and many tears and trials happened to me by the plotting of the Jews, and how I kept back nothing that was helpful, but proclaimed it to you and taught you publicly and from house to house. You know, I visited you in your homes, I taught you, you know, on the Sabbaths, wherever we could gather, testifying to the Jews and also to the Greeks, repentance toward God and faith toward our Lord Jesus Christ. And now I go bound in the Spirit to Jerusalem, not knowing what things might happen to me there, except the Holy Spirit testifies in every city, saying the chains and tribulation await me." But he goes on to warn them. Let me see, where's that part where there would be some who would rise up from among you in verse 30. "Also from among yourselves," or after my departure, verse 29, "I know this, after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you. Some will come into the church, really aren't converted at all. And they'll try to get into the ministry so they can lead you away and you support them. And you're going to be torn apart that way. Also from among yourselves, men will rise up, speaking perverse things to draw disciples after themselves. Therefore, watch and remember, for 3 years I did not cease to warn everybody, night and day, and with tears." So you think, well, okay, where are the ravenous wolves in the book of Ruth? He's there, that old so-and-so. All he was interested in was getting a following or getting funding for himself, enlarging his own affairs. Now, he wasn't quite as vicious as what Paul is talking about, but when you go back and you look at Ruth, he's not willing to do his duty. He's focused on self. And we've had, unfortunately, that happen because we're human. In our own history, and you read back and further into the history of the church, you see it happening periodically. It's patterned. Human nature has its weaknesses, and Satan will attack them. There will be false teachers and false prophets. The Apostle Peter talked about that. If you turn now to 2 Peter chapter 4, get to our last 2 points here. 2 Peter chapter 4. He was warning, very similar to the Apostle Paul's warning. Same chapter 2, I'm sorry, not chapter 4, it's chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you." Now, Paul or Peter just compared Old Testament to New Testament, Israel to the church, physical Israel to spiritual Israel. "There were false prophets," Kor, Dathan, and Abiram, days of Moses. "There were false prophets at other times that rose up among the people. And there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, denying that the Lord who bought them and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle and their destruction does not slumber." It is a continuing pattern from ancient Israel into physical Israel, into spiritual Israel, the church. So we watch for that, the so-and-sos, the Palani Alani, who we have to beware of and realize that it has happened before and make sure that we're not part of the Palani Alani. We don't want to be the old so-and-sos either. Now, we want to be faithful and dedicated like Ruth was and Boaz was and Naomi was. Now we do the final point, though, you know, those marvelous words, wherever you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your God will be my God. Let's compare that. That was Ruth 1, verses 16 and 17. To 1 Peter, and just back a few pages here in 1 Peter. Chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 2, we'll read verses 9 and 10. You know, wherever you go, I will go. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Peter says, you are a chosen generation, saying this to the church, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Well, the priesthood, nation, that all is drawn from ancient Israel and now being applied to spiritual Israel. His own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who were once not a people, but now are the people of God. Israel was once not a people when it went into Egypt, but when it came out of Egypt, it was a people, a large people. The church, of course, is smaller than that by far. We weren't a people. We didn't even know each other in many respects, but now we do. Who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. See that comparison? Now over in chapter 4 for our final point here of how God calls all mankind ultimately, and the church is the agency of his calling, and we are a part of that church. A continuum from Old Testament to New Testament, physical Israel to spiritual Israel, from the church in the wilderness to the church of God. Chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lewdness and lusts and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries. And you think, what are the Gentiles doing that for? That was how they worshiped their gods and their goddesses. That was the doctrines of paganism. That's why it was so powerful, and it had such a pull sexually and emotionally on the church, even in Peter and Paul's day, because it was all around them. It was like an addiction in the society, and we have a similar society now. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run after them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. That they'll give an account to him when the time comes. And he goes on talking about God, how God judges. We are a chosen generation in God's church today. Certainly, just like ancient Israel was a chosen nation. We're a chosen generation, a people who were the people before the church is. And we're not a part of the religions of this world. They aren't our religions. We're a part of the true religion of Jesus Christ and God the Father. We have a calling, brethren. It is phenomenal. Ruth recognized that relationship that predated the spiritual church. And she's one of the ones, I believe, and certainly Naomi and Boaz, who we would see in the first resurrection, the few that were called out of physical Israel to be converted in the way that we understand conversion. But the lesson of Ruth is powerful for us today. Her people were God's people. She chose to leave the background she came from to follow God. Let us do the same.